Well, I'm going to ask for a song to be played to us in a minute, just the first verse of a secular song. If you can't hear the words, don't worry, because I will read them to you afterwards. If you don't like the song, don't worry either, because it won't be very long, and I won't make you listen to it again. But I'd like you to listen to this song. It's by Sinead O'Connor, and I think it touches on the beginnings of what we're going to talk about this morning. Maybe some of us have seen the video that came out with it. It was one of the more memorable ones, one of the more striking ones that I've seen. It just is of her face as she sings with very delicate, striking features, but her hair cropped really short and a tear running down her cheek. And I think the words, which are very simple, are quite haunting. It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant. But nothing, I said nothing, can take away these blues. Because nothing compares to you. And she, of course, is singing about having her heart broken. As in most pop songs, the reason her heart is broken is because she has been left by the one she loves. If you have ever had that experience, then I think the song touches the nerve very well. When you lose someone like that, there's often a sense of numbness, and you can count every minute of time passing, 7 hours and 15 days. There's often a sense of life being thrown into confusion. I go out every night and sleep all day, she sings. There's a sense of having lots of new choices now, every single one of them seeming absolutely pointless. There's a feeling that you'll never be happy again. The sense that nothing on earth or heaven will ever take away those feelings and fill again the yawning hole that's been left behind. Because nothing compares, no, nothing compares to you. If that's ever happened to you, then you'll know that it's not very nice at all. And you may also know, which the pop songs don't always acknowledge, that there are plenty of other ways of having your heart broken than simply having someone walk out on you. I'm sure that when someone dies on you, it's much, much worse. And your heart can also be broken by your children, or your parents, or your friends. It can be broken by your experiences at work, the failure of your dreams and ambitions, the frustration of dearly held plans. You can find yourself grieving for your child or for your childhood. And to top it off, you can even break your own heart by your own actions and seeing their consequences rebound on you and those you love as you let others down and you let yourself down. In fact, I'd be very surprised if any of us got through life with our hearts intact. Whether a sudden crushing experience or a long, slow crumble, deep down we know all of us will face great sadness at some point in our lives. What a depressing start for an Easter morning sermon, eh? As if I could say anything that could fix a broken heart or could prevent a broken heart from happening. Of course not. We all know that there is no day-to-day cure that takes the pain away from these situations. We all know there is no escape from them happening. We all know that sometimes the only thing that can help is the passage of time. But even if there isn't a day-to-day cure that takes the pain away, the message of Easter is that there is an ultimate cure. There is a final answer provided for all the broken hearts of the world, if they're willing to receive it. The cure is someone in whom we can put our faith and trust. Someone who will never walk out on us. Someone who will not even die on us. And our faith is not just that he will make us feel all right again, but that he will once and for all do away with broken hearts forever and ever. And the ultimate answer for broken hearts is Jesus Christ, raised from the dead. And we see just a glimpse, a picture, if you like, of that, as we see what happens when Jesus actually met a broken heart on Easter morning. It's that story of Mary Magdalene. I hope you've got it in front of you if you want to look down at it from time to time. On page 1089, John chapter 20, verse 10. Remember how that little story that Stuart read to us begins. The disciples went back to their homes, verse 10. But Mary stood outside the tomb, crying. Now, what about this Mary Magdalene? We actually know much less about her than we may think. Speculation and tradition have filled the gaps in the record and come up with all kinds of things about Mary Magdalene. And it's also rather confusing because there are lots of other Marys in the Bible as well. You may have heard, for instance, that Mary was a reformed prostitute. But the Bible doesn't say that. And I don't think we should either. Could be embarrassing when we meet her in heaven, couldn't it? What little we do know about her past is actually recorded in Luke's Gospel. And that's dramatic enough. Let me read to you a few verses that tell us what we do know about Mary Magdalene's background. And just after, as Jesus has travelled from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God, it says the 12 were with him, and also some women who have been cured of evil spirits and diseases. And we discover that Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out, was one of them, along with Joanna, Susanna, and many others. These women, it says, were helping to support them, Jesus and the disciples, out of their own means. So we learn that Mary had been one of Jesus' support team. And before that, Mary had been trapped by the power of evil, a kind of living death that we call demon possession. Now maybe you don't know many people today who are possessed by supernatural evil forces. Probably not. But I tell you, there are plenty of people who are similarly enslaved. If not by that, then by drugs, or by drink, or by addiction to any number of things. Different causes, but much the same result. Like many people today, Mary Magdalene had been gripped by evil powers stronger than herself, and Jesus had come along and set her free. That much we do know about her. So we know that Mary Magdalene owed Jesus great gratitude for the marvellous thing he had done for her. Some people wonder whether there was more than that going on. The other piece of speculation that you sometimes hear is that Mary was actually in love with Jesus. Or even that there was something going on between them. Now, I've got no time for that. Whole films and books have been written about the idea. And it's actually blasphemous nonsense to suggest there was having an affair. But is it possible that Mary had special feelings for Jesus in her own heart? Was there a particular reason why Mary was the first to arrive at that tomb and the very last to leave? And why, out of all of the other disciples, she was the most determined that he should get the decent burial he deserves? Who knows? The fact that we do know is this. Jesus was the most wonderful, lovable man to ever walk the face of this earth. Jesus was everything a man is meant to be. He was kind. He was caring. He was passionate, yet in control of himself. He was gentle, yet strong. He was wise, yet simple. He was open, yet mysterious. Contrary to the picture that some people have in their minds, Jesus was not aloof or distant or otherworldly, up there somewhere. Jesus was approachable and affectionate and human. We read how he played with children. We read how his disciples rested their head back on his shoulders and vice versa. If you ask me, it would have been very surprising if no woman had ever felt attracted to him, or even in the quiet of their own hearts, fallen in love with him. What's more, we also know this. If they had done, Jesus would have understood completely. Because Jesus was completely and thoroughly human himself. Jesus was capable of such feelings. Indeed, the Bible tells us he was tempted in every way. So just like it's there for all of us, it was there for him too. But of course there was nothing actually going on. As if Jesus Christ would be so foolish and so cruel to a woman. That's not what he came to do. But as to what was going on in Mary's heart, whether she was grieving for more than just a teacher that morning, in the end, the Bible gives her her privacy, doesn't it? And perhaps we should too. But what we do know is, as Mary waters the garden with her tears, she was completely and totally heartbroken by what had happened. She had given the last 3 years of her life to him. She had been part of that team of close supporters for Jesus and the apostles. She had personally been very close to him. She clearly had a deep personal attachment to him. And she knew nothing compared to him. She had invested her life and her dreams in all that he was and all that he represented. And now it's gone. All in ruins. It's all torn away from her in the agony and the brutality of a crucifixion. What an awful way to die. How degrading. How humiliating. And where once in her life it had been full of this amazing, comforting, fascinating, wonderful person, now that's all gone. Now there's just empty despair. It's all ruined by those terrible, haunting images of that horrible crucifixion. And now this. The final insult. Can't they even leave him alone to rest in peace? They even have to interfere with him after he's dead, she thinks. Did you notice that? That's what's really taken the biscuit with her in this situation. Twice she's asked, "Why are you crying?" And the answer is not because Jesus is dead. The answer, as we see in verse 13, is, "They have taken my Lord away," she said. "And I don't know where they've put him." And it's like the last kick in the teeth, isn't it? She's been denied the chance to perform her final service, her last act of worship. And isn't it the case that in times of loss, it's often the little things that really spark us off, that really bring it home. And so the whole of life can feel spoiled, wrecked, destroyed. How does that poem go? W.H. Auden. "Stop all the clocks, cut off the telephone, prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone, silence the pianos and with muffled drum, bring out the coffin, let the mourners come. He was my north, my south, my east, my west, my working week, my Sunday rest, my noon, my midnight, my talk, my song. I thought that love would last forever. I was wrong. The stars are not wanted now. Put out every one. Pack up the moon and dismantle the sun. Pour away the ocean and sweep up the wood. For nothing now can ever come to any good." Well, I suspect that most of us here can identify with at least a little of what Mary was feeling that morning. And if we can't yet, we probably will one day. But I wonder, how many of us can identify with what happened next? "They've taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they've put him." At this, she turned round, and she saw Jesus standing there. But she didn't realize it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And what an amazing scene that must have been, as the first rays of the sun lit up the dawn. So the light dawns on her face. Recognition sweeps across it. I think it must have been one of the most moving scenes in the Bible. In fact, it almost seems too moving to be true, doesn't it? Like it's from a film or something like that. Can we really believe it, that this happened? And then more than that, can we really expect anything like this to happen in our own experience? Can we really expect to see sadness and mourning turn into joy quite so dramatically and remarkably? Can we really expect broken hearts to be healed so quickly? The answer is yes and no. No, we don't experience anything quite like this, do we? But yes, Jesus, Easter Day, is the ultimate answer for our broken hearts. No, we don't expect to run into the risen Jesus while we are out walking in the garden. As verse 17 says in this account, Jesus has returned to the Father. That's what he said to Mary, wasn't it? "I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." That means Jesus is still alive, but we don't meet him face to face, in person. He's no longer physically present. And I think that we all understand that, don't we? We meet Jesus spiritually by faith, through the Holy Spirit. Perhaps, though, more to the point, we also don't expect broken hearts to be healed in the blink of an eye. Sometimes when something awful has happened, you feel numb and shocked. You just wish you could go to bed, and you'd wake up in the morning and discover it was all a horrible, terrible dream, and everything is just as it was the day before. Maybe even deep down, you actually believe that's what's going to happen one day, because you feel so numb and you haven't really taken it in. Yet, of course, that's actually what happened to Mary, isn't it? More or less. In one moment of recognition, her whole nightmare suddenly turns into a dream world. But, of course, this story is not meant to teach us that if Jesus comes into your life, you can expect to find an easy answer to your grief and to your troubles. That's not what this story is supposed to teach us. Think about it. Of course not. Sooner or later, sadness returned to Mary Magdalene's life, didn't it? Maybe one day she stood by the grave of a parent, or a husband, or a child, and she knew that this person wasn't going to suddenly reappear. Becoming a Christian doesn't bring your loved ones back from the dead, or bring back your lost, long-lost love from far away. Of course, in some ways, and sometimes, we find our whole life changed around from sadness to joy, just like that, but it's not what's promised to us here. And more to the point, it's not actually what our broken hearts really need. That's not actually what we need. Let me try and explain. You see, so much of the time, we sort of look at our lives, and if there isn't much wrong about them, if life is getting on okay, we don't even think about the bigger issues. We tend to just toddle on with life without ever really giving a thought to what's coming ahead. But then something tragic goes wrong. We get into trouble. We fall sick. We experience loss. Our hearts get broken. And then we start to think, oh, I need something to make life better again. This hurts. I need something to heal me, to take the pain away, to solve the problem, to answer the question, to make me feel better, to put me back to where I used to be, or where in my imagination I think I used to be. And maybe we think that God's job really ought to be to help us out in that process. That the purpose of religion is to do that sort of thing, to patch us up and to make us feel better when awful things happen. And of course, in many ways, faith can give us strength and so on. But that is not primarily what Jesus came to do, you see. That is not the hope of Easter. It's not a paracetamol to take away the pain. It is heart surgery to solve the problem. What Jesus came to do is reconnect our lives back into a relationship with God so that we could call him our Father. Notice what he said to Mary. I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God. That's what we need most of all, to be able to join with Jesus and say, his God is my God, his Father is my Father. The troubles and the sorrows we experience in this life, although they hurt so much, are not the deep problem of the human race. They're just the symptoms, not the disease itself. The real problem, the reason why so many hearts get broken in this world, and our lives end up in a mess, and we all end up dead, is that our sins have cut us off from God. They've brought a terrible disharmony into our universe. By nature, we tend to live with God as our enemy, not as our Father. We turn our backs on him and do things our own way. And that is where all human heartbreak has its origins. The spoiling of life by our rejection of God. We choose to live under a curse rather than under his blessing. And that has messed up everything, cradle to grave. No point of human life is untouched. If our hearts are ever going to be mended, then we need to be back in a happy relationship with God again. And that is why Easter is so wonderful. You see, it's not merely a vague sign of hope, like flowers in the spring. Oh, things might just get back to how they were again. It's not merely the promise of comfort here and now for our sorrows. It's the proof. It's the living demonstration that Jesus has done all it takes to reconnect our lives back to God as our Father. And that is the ultimate answer to our broken hearts. And that is the wonderful truth that was beginning to dawn on Mary that morning as well. It wasn't merely that Jesus wasn't dead after all. The truth she's beginning to realize is that something much, much greater has happened. Not just setting the clock back to how things were before, but moving it on. Because Jesus has defeated death. And he's returned to God so that he can send new life to the whole world, to every broken heart that wants it. Jesus mends our hearts by dealing with our past. As Sinead O'Connor laments her loss in that song, she cries out, "Where did I go wrong?" And she's not alone, is she? Very often in sadness, we can find ourselves wondering whether we're being punished for something. Looking for reasons to blame ourselves for what's happened. Believing that it's somehow our fault. And of course, in lots of specific situations, that's just nonsense. That's just false guilt. But sometimes it isn't. Sometimes we really have brought tragedy on ourselves. And the fact of the matter is, we are all sinners. One way or another, we have offended against God. And the only reason sorrow and suffering is in our lives is because we are that kind of person. Whether or not we've actually caused that particular tragedy to happen. Well, when Jesus died on the cross on Good Friday, he was paying the price for that. He was wiping the slate clean for everyone who believes in him and puts their faith in him, so that you no longer look back and think, "Why did I go wrong?" Because Jesus has paid for it completely. Jesus mends our hearts by dealing with the past. Jesus mends our hearts by giving us a new future as well. The disciples would have understood this when Mary repeated his words, "I'm returning to my Father and to your Father, to my God and to your God." Because earlier on, he said he was going to go back to his Father's house, is what he said, and make a place for his disciples there. And Easter is the promise to all of us who believe that we too can have a place in heaven with him, where every tear will be wiped away by God himself, every guilty stain washed clean, every painful memory healed and made good again. Past, future, now. Jesus heals our hearts by meeting us now. Not face to face, but by his Spirit, convincing us that he really is alive and we can entrust ourselves to him. As we turn away with sorrow in our hearts from a godless way of living and look to a new future that he's won for us, we do not find our present troubles and heartbreaks removed. But we do find that a healed past and a certain future give us a strength and a resource to live through them. He can give us fresh purpose too. Mary had spent the last 3 years serving Jesus. And Jesus did not give her past back. He didn't turn the clock back and say, "There you go, carry on what you were doing before." He doesn't do that. But instead, he gave her a new reason for living. "Go and tell others the good news that I'm alive," he says. Far more valuable than making the sandwiches and washing the socks for the disciples, don't you think? You know, I reckon there are many more Mary Magdalenes than there are doubting Thomases. You know the doubting Thomases, don't you? They need evidence that the issues are intellectual doubts. Well, the first part of the service was for doubting Thomases, as we thought about the evidence. But I think there are many more Mary Magdalenes for whom the struggles are not the intellectual doubts, but the emotional pain. And I know it is much, much harder to answer the questions for you Mary Magdalenes than it is for you doubting Thomases. Give me a doubting Thomas any day, I think I've got an answer for you. But the Mary Magdalenes, I don't pretend to be able to have an answer for you. But since when was being a Christian about knowing what the answers are? Being a Christian is about knowing who the answer is and trusting him. In the midst of our sorrows, we don't often see very straight at all. As Mary was weeping by that tomb, she doesn't seem to notice anything odd. For instance, the fact that there are two angels sitting inside the tomb, sort of glowing away in the dark, most of us would think, "Oh, that's a bit strange. Maybe something is going on here." But she doesn't notice that. Perhaps she's crying too much. She's too preoccupied with what's on her heart. She doesn't recognize the voice behind her, does she? Or even recognize his face first time she turns round. Until he says her name to her. Then she turns around and she realizes that he's been with her all the time she was crying. Now, could it be that Jesus is there for you, just waiting for you to turn around as well, quietly saying your name, waiting for you to hear it and realize Jesus is alive again, risen from the dead for you? And when someone like me can't give you an easy answer about what's happened in the past, Jesus can himself speak to you and enable you to trust him for the future. He can convince you in a personal way that his death is for you and his life is for you. And he can reconnect you personally back into the relationship with God that does give you new life, fresh start, hope and purpose in spite of the grief and troubles that we yet must bear. If you think it's just possible that you hear his voice calling your name, taking the truth and making it alive for you, don't keep your back turned. huddled away. Some people do that when they've been suffering. They curl up inside themselves, hold on to the pain and the resentment. They write tragic poetry like W.H. Auden and sing tragic songs like Sinead O'Connor. And so doing that, they keep God outside of the problem. He's the enemy. He is the problem. Why should I say sorry to him? He should be saying sorry to me for what he's done. And when we do that, we choose winter in a graveyard. But Christ is offering you springtime in the garden. That's the choice. Hold on to your pain and your resentment to God. Choose winter in the graveyard. Turn around. Trust him. And you will find springtime in the garden. Christ is calling you towards a future with God as your Father, who promises you a home in heaven with no more tears. And this Easter could be your personal springtime after a cold winter, your own sunrise after a long, dark night. So I'm going to invite you now, as I pray, to turn around and see whether Jesus really has been calling your name. I'm going to pray and invite you to listen in and echo my words in the quietness of your own heart for yourself, if you think you can believe them yourself.